Much of a team's work occurs in group meetings. It follows, then, that a team's performance and your own individual performance hinge on the quality of team meetings, how well people debate issues, and how fully they commit to implementing decisions. While team meetings are a crucial part of teamwork, many of them aren't effective, and there are lots of them. One source that summarized a range of studies calculated that 36 to 56 million meetings occur every day in the United States. And yet, in a worldwide Microsoft survey of 38,000 people, 69% said their meetings weren't productive. A Harris poll of 2,066 employees even found that almost half of respondents would prefer to do almost anything else instead of sitting in a status meeting. Would they rather watch paint dry? A full 17% said yes. Root canal? 8% nodded their heads. What do you do if your team has a poor meeting where you didn't resolve the issues? Meet again. One participant in our 5,000-person study who works in the finance department of a mid-sized manufacturing plant scolded Karen, his 42-year-old manager. My boss plans too many unnecessary meetings that rarely have final results. The meeting result is another planned meeting. One perverse consequence of all those ineffective team meetings is that they lead to even more meetings. We end up with volumes of activity, a work harder approach, because we didn't have a rigorous discussion in the first place. We don't need teams to conduct a vast number of meetings to get their work done. Rather, we need smarter team meetings where people debate rigorously and commit to decisions. But how do we accomplish that? Having one heck of a fight. In 2009, my quest to understand the secret behind superior team performance took me to Slough, an industrial area near London's Heathrow Airport. As part of a study unrelated to this book, my colleagues Erminia Ibarra, Urs Payer, and I had decided to create a ranking of the best-performing CEOs of major public companies. This study was published in the Harvard Business Review in 2010 and 2013. We pulled data on 2,000 CEOs and companies from across the world for every year since 1995. Stitching together reams of data across numerous spreadsheets, we ranked the CEOs from 1 to 2,000 based on stock market performance. When I received the final spreadsheet one morning sitting at my desk, I opened it, rubbed my hands in anticipation, and began scanning it from the top on down. The top-performing CEO was no surprise, Steve Jobs of Apple. The next few names were familiar, too. Leaders like Amazon's Jeff Bezos and others from fast-growing high-tech and energy companies. Numbers 5, 6, 7, 8 were all pretty interesting, but not surprising. 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. I yawned and looked out the window. Then I got to number 16. I put down my coffee mug. What was this? A CEO named Bart Becht, who ran a company called Reckitt Benckiser in England. I'd never heard of him. I looked up Reckitt Benckiser on the Internet. I assumed it must be some cool, high-tech company or an energy firm exploiting a growing market. As the company's page loaded, I almost fell off my chair. They sell soap. For dishwashers. The dishwasher soap industry is not exactly a high-growth business. So, how can you sell soap and be a top 1% performer among 2,000 companies? Okay, Reckitt Benckiser sells more than just soap, but still. I had to find out, so I called Bart Becht and asked if we could perform an analysis of them as part of our study. He agreed, and my research associates and I flew to company headquarters in Slough. We entered a small room lined with shelves holding the company's cleaning products. The place was little more than a closet. No fancy boardroom, no floor-to-ceiling windows, no portraits of the board of directors. There we interviewed Becht and later seven other executives. As we discovered, The company's superior performance had a lot to do with how their teams ran meetings. Two team meeting principles stood out among the rest. The first was something most of us don't feel good about: fighting. When teams have a good fight in their meetings, team members debate the issues, consider alternatives, challenge one another, listen to minority views, scrutinize assumptions, and enable every participant to speak up without fear of retribution. As Becht told us, he didn't like bland meetings in which everyone just went along with others and helped them feel good. No, he liked charged meetings in which people disagreed, argued, and yes, even fought. "We actually encourage constructive conflict," he said. "When there is a group of people who feel passionately about a set of ideas, I want to ensure those ideas are allowed to flourish. They should not be silenced by the majority consensus. And if they come armed with facts and are prepared to argue their point of view, they will be encouraged to keep working away. Of course, this can lead to some lively meetings." I'll say so. When executive Freddie Caspers first walked into a meeting upon joining the company in 2001, he was stunned to find a room full of people jumping up and down and arguing. "It's not like a physical fight," he said, "but you could say it's a mental fight." On another occasion, a mid-level marketer fought for a product called Airwick Freshmatic, a battery-operated dispenser that sprays air freshener at regular intervals. Over the previous 5 years, the company had only sold this product for use in South Korean office spaces. This marketer thought the company should sell it in other countries, not just in offices, but in homes as well. His colleagues considered this idea completely nuts and said so, according to an article in Bloomberg Businessweek. That would have ended it in most companies, but after a strenuous debate, his minority view prevailed. Airwick Freshmatic launched in 69 countries. Based on our interviews, I tried to discern the unspoken rules, social scientists call them implicit norms, for having a good fight at Reckitt Benckiser. I came up with the following list. Show up to every meeting 100% prepared. Craft an opinion and deliver it with conviction and data. Stay open to others' ideas, not just your own. Let the best argument win, even if it isn't yours, and often it isn't. Feel free to stand up and shout, but never make the argument personal. Always listen, really listen, to minority views. Never pursue consensus for its own sake. At Reckitt Benckiser, team members didn't take any decisions until they had turned over the options, exploring the pros and cons. Yes, meetings sometimes grew heated, but in the end, this rough-and-tumble way of interacting produced high-quality, considered decisions. And as everyone we interviewed agreed, this way of working in teams led to much better performance. Unite. And yet, these norms by themselves also posed a danger. They could lead to endless debate. That's why at Reckitt Benckiser, another set of norms arose around a second principle: fostering unity. The company expected managers in a meeting to decide quickly and commit to a decision. Becht recalled a meeting in Amsterdam between managers from the recently merged companies Benckiser of the Netherlands, where Becht was CEO, and Reckitt and Coleman in England. The managers had labored through a difficult session, and time was running out. After lunch, one of the Reckitt and Coleman managers announced that the team needed to wrap the meeting up in order for his group to catch their flight back to London on time, but the two sides had yet to agree. This made the Benckiser people very nervous. They had grown accustomed to never leaving a meeting without a clear agreement and an abiding sense of team unity. "So what happened?" I asked Becht. "Did the Benckiser guys lock the door to the conference room?" Becht chuckled. "That's exactly what happened. They said, 'Nobody is leaving until we take a decision.'" Once teams discussed issues, they achieved closure and moved quickly. If a Reckitt Benckiser team couldn't decide within a reasonable period of time, The senior person in the room, usually the chair, made the final call. Every meeting ended with a judgment that was acted upon, fast. You're through and out the other side at the speed of light, and then on to the next one, one executive said of meetings at the company. Everyone also committed to implementing the decision. No second-guessing or political maneuvering would transpire in the hallways to undermine a path already chosen. I think politics is poison, Becht said about the tendency to undermine decisions. Reckitt Benckiser performed so well in part because so many of its managers and employees not only fought, but also united. In teams that unite, team members commit to the decision taken, even if they disagree, and all work hard to implement the decision without second-guessing or undermining it. We find similar teamwork cultures at other high-performance companies. At Amazon, the company expects managers and employees to challenge decisions when they disagree, even when doing so is uncomfortable or exhausting. And once a decision is determined, they commit wholly. Silicon Valley investor Mark Andreessen described how his company's investment team debates when a partner proposes a deal. It's the responsibility of everybody else in the room to stress test the thinking, Andreessen says. Whenever partner Ben Horowitz brings in a deal, I just beat the S out of him. And I might think it's the best idea I've ever heard, and I'll just, like, trash the crap out of it. And I'll get everybody else to pile on. If the partner prevails, they will stop arguing. We'll say, okay, we're all in. We're all behind you. We don't see too many examples like these, and they characterize company cultures, not individual behaviors throughout the company. I wondered if managers and employees in the trenches who pursued the pattern of fighting and then uniting would perform better than those who didn't. Our statistical analysis of 5,000 managers and employees found that those who mastered both fighting and uniting in their teams did perform better overall than those who didn't fight and unite. Persistent gender stereotypes hold that men are naturally better at the tough task of fighting in team meetings, while women are better at the interpersonal job of forging unity. Our quantitative study refutes these perceptions. In our sample, just under 30% of men scored high for their ability to fight in discussions, as compared with 32% of women. Women were slightly better at uniting, with about 38% scoring highly, as opposed to 34% of men. But these are small differences. Our research also showed that more education doesn't make someone better at fighting and uniting teams, yet another blow to the best and brightest team strategy. Nor are senior leaders any better at it than more junior staff. This last finding might seem surprising. I would have expected that people in positions of authority would have enforced unity better. But unity is not something that you enforce. You need true commitment, not mere obedience. So how can you get better at fighting and uniting? Let's first review some tactics for showing up at a meeting and having one heck of a productive fight. Seek diversity, not just talent. A team can't fight well unless it encompasses diverse viewpoints. Decades of research in the social sciences confirm that diverse groups are more creative and debate better. Columbia Business School professor Catherine Phillips has concluded that diversity encourages the search for novel information and perspectives, leading to better decision-making and problem-solving. Likewise, University of Michigan professor Scott Page has demonstrated that the key to a fruitful debate is cognitive diversity, the presence of dissimilar perspectives on an issue. He argues that diversity based on demographics and expertise helps insofar as it makes people see the world from different vantages and with different information. Most people don't assemble teams or show up at meetings with diversity in mind. We tend to mingle with people like ourselves, what sociologists call homophily. When we seek out the best and the brightest, we don't look far, but instead tend to gather teams with people whose backgrounds resemble our own. President Kennedy's national security team may have been exceptionally bright, but it comprised an amazingly homogeneous group that sat around the conference table. White males in their 40s and 50s, hailing from the same elite universities. Further, none of the best and the brightest in President Kennedy's team sought to bring external dissenting viewpoints into the debate. When planning the operation, the CIA, according to Arthur Schlesinger, estimated that the brigade, once established on the island, could expect the active support of, at the very least, a quarter of the Cuban people. Why else would President Kennedy have agreed to send 1,400 men to fight Castro's army of more than 20,000? The plan rested on the crucial assumption that the Cuban people would rise up in revolt. But no one reached out to the Cuba desk at the Department of State, which had information indicating that Castro was still widely admired, and that an uprising would not likely follow. Had one person on the team, Mann, Schlesinger, McNamara, Rusk, sought and provided that different perspective, the team would have had a more exacting debate about this crucial assumption. To fight better, try to bring in people with more diverse backgrounds and viewpoints. Bart Becht of Reckitt Benckiser told us, "It doesn't matter whether I have a Pakistani, a Chinese person, a Brit or a Turk, man or woman, sitting in the same room, whether I have people who have done sales or something else, so long as I have people with different experiences, because the chance for new ideas is much greater when you have people with different backgrounds." If you're a participant, you don't necessarily get to pick who's on your team or who gets invited into the conference room. Still, you can inject diversity by seeking out viewpoints and information from different places. Go consult peers who are not part of the team. Find that new market report that no one has bothered to consult. Seek out the crazy engineer who always has a contrarian thought. Then bring these different viewpoints to the next team meeting, either by inviting those people or presenting their views. Some people in our study did just that. Gunther, a 38-year-old engineer at a South Carolina electric utility, suspected that a contractor working on one of the company's power plants was implementing a wrong solution. Gunther organized a meeting with the team, the contractor, his boss, and two other engineers from his company who had not been involved and who would bring new perspectives. During the meeting, one of the engineers whom Gunther had invited proposed a very different but seemingly superior solution to the contractors. "The contractor wasn't listening to him," Gunther said. "But my boss was very good about advocating for the engineer in the meeting so that his voice was heard." Even though Gunther was junior, he orchestrated the meeting and enhanced the intellectual diversity in the room. He scored in the 98th percentile on the fight and unite principle and in the top 6% in performance in our study. Make it safe. In 2009, Heineken brought its young talent, lanky 36-year-old Dutchman Dolph Vandenbrink, into its regional headquarters in White Plains, New York, to turn around its sagging U.S. operation. Vandenbrink had worked in the Congo, Africa, where he had doubled the local business's market share in a few short years. When I spoke to him, he recalled that when he started, there was a lot of fear at the headquarters, and nobody was speaking their mind. To provoke discussion, he couldn't just yell, "Speak up, people." No. He had to set clear expectations. Vandenbrink hit upon the idea of using props to establish new rules for meetings. When his team members filed into the room one morning, they noticed several 2x3-inch cards on the table. The red card read, "Challenge. Have another solution." Another, a green card, declared, "All in. Ask me why." The last card was gray with a warning. "Shiny object alerts. Get back on track." Every team member could grab and hold up one of the cards to disagree. Red. Support a point of view. Green. Or refocus a colleague who was going off in the wrong direction. Gray. There was also a toy horse, which people could toss at a speaker who was blathering on for too long, as in beating a dead horse. Was this silly? You bet. But on purpose. As Vandenbrink explained, There was so much fear that everybody was looking to me or whoever was most senior in the room. What the presence of the red card meant was that anybody could legitimately raise a challenge. Putting those cards there, in kind of a funny way, sent a signal. Guys, we want you to challenge us. We want to hear you. By setting expectations and inviting people to speak, Vandenbrink cultivated an atmosphere of psychological safety. As Harvard professor Amy Edmondson calls it, a climate in which people feel free to express work-relevant thoughts and feelings. In our study, about a fifth of participants, 19%, were adept at creating such climates, scoring very high on the statement, he or she is extremely good at making people feel it is safe to speak up in meetings. As the data showed, those who scored high performed better. The correlation was a high 0.63. At Heineken, Vandenbrink's tactic worked. Over time, people on his team started to speak up. Soon the cards were no longer needed, and they disappeared from the room. Alejandra de Obeso, who was working in strategic planning at the time, noticed how the new expectations had enabled quiet people to participate vibrantly in the discussions. There was one person with an introverted nature who significantly changed, she remarked. This person always had a very nuanced point of view of what was going on in meetings, but was anxious about sharing it. Over time, urged on by a sense of inclusiveness and clear rules for debate, this person began to speak up, becoming a reconciling force and taking the conversation a level further. Vandenbrink believes that the shift to vigorous debate enabled his team to introduce more new products. As he reflected in 2015, our innovation rate was essentially flat 4 years ago. Now, 6% of our revenues are generated by the products we have launched the last 3 years. The more you can improve the quality of the debate, the better the quality of the outcomes. More innovation benefited the company, and Vandenbrink too. He received another promotion, a coveted position in Mexico running Heineken's largest local operating company. Prod the quiet to speak. Even with clear expectations in place, many shy and quiet people will still refrain from speaking up. In her book, Quiet, Susan Cain describes how introverted people, those who prefer their own inner mental life and solitary activities, find it hard to participate in buzzing, heated meetings where loud people wave their arms and contest the point. They often feel left out of the discussion. Tammy, a 49-year-old lawyer in a data analysis company, prods quiet colleagues to contribute. Sometimes I'll talk to folks in advance of a meeting saying, hey, we're going to have this meeting. I know you have a particular viewpoint. I think it's very important that it gets heard. I'd like to make sure you share it with the group. Tammy ranked in the top 10% among our 5,000 study participants in stimulating debate, and in the top 20% in performance. Donald, a 44-year-old engineer who designs components for nuclear power plants, gets quiet colleagues to speak up by provoking a reaction. I sometimes throw out a ridiculous answer. I find people will speak up and say, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
He'll then ask them what they think.
I poke and prod the folks who are sitting there quietly, looking out the window, to get the entire team involved in the answer. Donald scored in the top 20% on fostering debate and in the top 14% in performance overall in our study. Speak up correctly. If you're a team participant, you can also model participation by speaking up yourself. Beware, though. Not all forms of participation are equally helpful. Of the following four mindsets you might have during a team discussion, only one advances debate. Can you identify which? 1. I am here just to listen. 2. I want to sell people hard on my idea. 3. I am completely impartial in meetings. 4. I advocate my ideas. If you answered 4, then you're in good company among high performers. You're not in meetings to just listen. You're there to contribute. Good performers also don't show up behaving like an impartial academic. On one hand, I think... On the other hand, I think... You're also not there to sell your ideas. What matters isn't whether your suggestions get accepted. It's whether the team can generate the best possible solution, which may or may not involve your solution. CIA Deputy Richard Bissell didn't understand this point when discussing the Bay of Pigs invasion. He thought that his job was to get his plan approved, when in reality, it was to help the group to get the best decision. Bissell later confessed, "So emotionally involved was I that I may have let my desire to proceed override my good judgment on several matters." Those emotions led him to speak less candidly with the president about the risks of the operation, so that his plan would go ahead. It is possible that we in the agency were not as frank with the president about deficiencies as we could have been. He didn't grasp that good advocacy involves not only recommending a solution, but also articulating the assumptions underlying it and its weaknesses. The failure to advocate properly cost Bissell. He was pushed out of the CIA after the fiasco. The best performers advocate properly. They craft an opinion, argue their case with vigor, outline its weaknesses and assumptions, listen to other points of view, debate the issues, and change their mind if warranted. Here are my tips for debating and listening, drawn from my conversations with hundreds of managers and employees. Tips for debating well. Present new data. I pulled some market data from Atlanta that is interesting. Jot down three questions beforehand, and especially around key assumptions. Does your number assume that customers will buy additional products? Jump into a dissenting role. For the sake of argument, let me state an alternative point of view. Build on other viewpoints. If we expand your idea to a larger market, change your mind from time to time. Fight for the best idea, not for yours. Tips for listening well, so that you can build on what others say. Don't interrupt. Let others finish their thoughts, except for that long-winded colleague. Don't listen just to prepare your own answer. First, listen to understand, a golden nugget from Stephen Covey's Seven Habits. Paraphrase what someone else said and check it for accuracy. Did I get that right? Make eye contact with whoever is speaking. Don't snooze or doodle or cross arms. Even if you are listening, your body language may suggest that you are not. Ask non-leading questions. Look for the truth, not for confirmation of your views. Put away that smartphone. Multitasking doesn't work. Ask non-leading questions. On February 1st, 2003, NASA's Space Shuttle Columbia broke apart upon re-entry to Earth, killing all seven astronauts on board. Earlier in the mission, while Columbia was traveling in space, mission manager Linda Hamm had scheduled a team meeting to go over a number of items. These included an assessment of foam that had broken off from the shuttle's external tank and struck the left wing during takeoff. Was the foam a mere maintenance issue or a safety concern? Hamm hoped it was a maintenance issue. If it were a safety concern, the team would have to take drastic action with the shuttle now in orbit. In the meeting, Hamm asked an engineer whether the foam had caused severe damage by burning through the shield. No burn through means no catastrophic damage, and localized heating damage would mean a tile replacement? The engineer responded that it didn't seem to be a safety of flight issue, which was just what she'd wanted to hear. Hamm followed up. No safety of flight and no issue for this mission? Nothing we're going to do different? There may be a turnaround issue? The engineer came back with more of an equivocal explanation this time. Hamm again. Would be a turnaround issue only? Hamm asked again and again, seeking confirmation of the answer she desired, that the foam damage was a maintenance issue only. Like Hamm, people often have a confirmation bias, asking for information that supports what they want to hear. Ham got her answer, even though the engineers remained uncertain about the state of the foam damage, which, as it turned out, was the cause of the disaster. In the hearings following the accident, she came under heavy criticism for her inability to probe the issue. As a manager, how do you seek out dissenting opinions?
Well, when I hear about them...
But Linda, by their very nature, you may not hear about them.
Well, when somebody comes forward and tells me about them.
But Linda, what techniques do you use to get them?
She did not reply.
People who crave to learn the truth about an issue don't ask leading questions. They ask open-ended questions, inquiries that do not convey an opinion or bias. Ham would have been better off putting her query this way. What's your view on the foam damage? Or she could have asked, does someone have a different point of view? Or, can someone argue the opposite point of view? Make it fair, then commit. After you fight, you must unite. That means people on a team have to commit to a decision, to agree to it, and exert effort to implement it. So why wouldn't people commit? Research on the topic of fair processes in groups has shown that employees have trouble committing to a decision when they perceive the process as unfair. In a meta-analysis of 148 field studies covering 56,531 employees, Professors Yochi Cohen-Karash and Paul E. Spector conclude that employees viewed a process as unfair if they could not voice their opinions before a decision was made. That perception, in turn, led people to harbor negative attitudes and engage in counterproductive behaviors, including spreading rumors, doing work incorrectly, and even stealing and destroying equipment. The first requirement to get people to commit, then, is to make sure everyone on the team has a chance to express their opinions and that people consider and discuss them. Then, people will be more likely to commit to a decision, even if they disagree with it. Employees in our study recounted instances when they committed to decisions even when they objected. Christine worked for a pharmaceutical company selling skin treatment products to dermatologists. She described how she once clashed with her team's decision to add a new product. I'll call it fungi that treats nail fungus. In Christine's view, the sales force didn't have enough expertise to educate doctors about fungi. In a heated discussion, her boss asked for opinions around the table. Christine voiced her strong dissent, which led to a lively discussion, but she lost the argument. Fungi became part of the lineup. But Christine didn't mope, in part because she felt the team had listened to her dissent. She threw herself at the challenge. She devoured product information, was the first to attend a training course, and called the company's experts to learn all she could about fungi. She shot emails to her clients to alert them to their new offering and suggested that she pay them a visit to showcase the product. She evangelized to her colleagues. In short, she rallied behind the decision and did all she could to make it a success. Stop playing politics. Office politics can undermine unity. People scuttle team decisions if those decisions conflict with their own selfish agendas. But as our study found, participants who scored high on she or he goes to great lengths to eliminate politics that would prevent a decision from being implemented performed much better. The correlation was 0.61. To stop playing politics and forge unity, try the following. Don't second-guess team decisions that go against your personal interests. Avoid that hallway chatter. I'm not sure we should be doing that. Don't appeal a team decision that conflicts with your personal agenda to higher ups. Accept it and move on. Clarify with your boss any conflict that may exist between your individual goals and a team goal. I can't spend 100% of my time selling insurance when the new team goal requires me to help sell mortgages, too. Send an email declaring your support to the team. I am on board. Do one thing
fast that shows you're implementing the decision, even if it goes against your interests. I've already set up the meeting with the supplier. Confront a colleague who's playing politics. We made the decision. Stop second-guessing. Let's go and do it. Confront the prima donna. It was the Eastern Conference semifinals in 1994 between the Chicago Bulls and the New York Knicks. The two basketball teams were tied at 102 with 1.8 seconds left in the game. The Bulls had lost the first two games of the best-of-seven series. They needed to win this game to keep their hopes alive. With the Bulls in possession of the ball, they called a timeout and huddled outside with their coach, Phil Jackson. A meager 1.8 seconds was just enough for one final shot and a chance to win. Up to this point, Bulls superstar Scottie Pippen had propelled Chicago to 55 wins, only two fewer than legend Michael Jordan had during the team's previous season. Since Jordan's retirement, Pippen had emerged as the team's star. At the break, Pippen expected the coach to let him take the final shot and become the game's hero. Instead, Jackson drew up a play for rookie Tony Kukoc to take the shot. After the huddle, Pippen sulked at the far end of the bench. "Are you in or out?" Jackson asked. "I'm out." After the game, a terse Jackson confirmed of Pippen. He asked out of the play. "I left him off the floor." That's right. At the moment that mattered the most, the star of the team didn't want to play because the coach didn't let him have the ball. It was man over team, an egotistical outburst that earned Pippen a spot in a ranking of the 50 most unsportsmanlike acts in sports history. But Pippen didn't get away with his bad behavior. Back in the locker room after the game, teammate Bill Cartwright, with tears in his eyes, laid into Pippen. "Look, Scotty, that was bullshit. After all we've been through on this team, this is our chance to do it on our own, without Michael, and you blow it with your selfishness. I've never been so disappointed in my whole life." The team looked on in silence. Pippen apologized for letting his team down. It was a stunning and unforgettable moment of loss. Yet Kukoc had made that final shot, winning the game 104-102. Sometimes people on a team act in their own interest, like Pippen, without regard for what's best for the team. If these prima donnas don't get their way, they stop contributing, or they keep on challenging a decision, even though it has been made and everyone else is working hard to implement it. Such selfish behaviors make it impossible for teams to unite. The answer is to do what Cartwright did. Call out the prima donnas on the team. Peer pressure can often serve to discipline even the most selfish individual star. Cynthia, a 38-year-old lean Six Sigma black belt manager in our 5,000-person data set, used peer pressure when her team didn't reach consensus. Her team had set clear ground rules early on in the project. Once a decision was reached, team members should commit to it 100%, even if they disagreed. "We have people on the team saying, 'I don't want to do it this way,' but the bottom line is, if the direction of the team is that way, everyone has to support it." On one occasion, a few strong-willed team members broke the rules and pursued their own agenda. Cynthia confronted them one-on-one. I let them know that their action wasn't supportive of the decision and undermined it. She demanded they commit 100%. The wavering teammates agreed. Cynthia scored a nearly top score, 6 of 7, on the statement, "Makes sure everyone buys into decisions once they are made," and she placed in the top 16% in the performance ranking. In some cases, the leader must take firm action, getting rid of a selfish star. One CEO I interviewed for our study recalled a dreadful moment when he did just that. He had launched a turnaround plan for a crisis-ridden steel mill in Pittsburgh. The plan involved huge cost reductions and layoffs. His whole team signed on to this plan, except the chief financial officer, who thought the cost reductions too drastic.
Every time the team met to discuss how to implement the cost cutting, he disrupted the meeting by revisiting whether they should cut costs that much. The leader took the CFO aside and warned him about his insubordination, but it persisted. After 5 months, the CEO sat down with the CFO and said, "You know, this is not working out. We need to part ways." Furious, the troublemaker stormed out. "It was the best and most difficult decision I made for that turnaround," the CEO told me. Don't let a single disruptive person prevent the entire team from implementing a decision that has been well argued. Many people fail to intervene in such situations. Conversely, if you confront, like Pippin's teammate Bill Cartwright, Cynthia, and the steel mill CEO did, you'll increase your team's and your own performance. Sharpen the team goal. In many teams, personal goals and infighting prevail because the team lacks a compelling common goal. Team members retreat into their own individual interests, and before too long, team unity dissolves. You can unite a team by sharpening the team goal. In a business school case I wrote with famed mountaineer and filmmaker David Brashears and INSEAD professor Ludo Vanderhaden, we described how David led a team up Mount Everest in May 1996 to make a movie using an IMAX camera. Three team members were trying to scale the mountain for the first time. Any climber in this situation yearns to reach the summit. That's a selfish goal, not a team objective. The IMAX team, however, had a clear and compelling collective goal. Get that 90-pound heavy camera, which they affectionately called the Pig, on top of the mountain so that they could capture the shot from the summit. Keep in mind, every ounce counts on a journey up Everest. Climbers will cut a toothbrush in half to save weight on the exhausting trip into thin air. So hauling the Pig up the mountain was a colossal affair. The team goal, get the Pig to the top, drove every decision and united the team. Individual goals, such as summiting, were secondary. Pig over person. In one instance, Brashears ordered Sumio, a Japanese climber on the team, to stay behind on summit day because she was climbing a bit slower than the rest. The team could not afford to slow down, even though she was a strong individual climber. In the end, the team made it. Team members filmed their movie on top of Everest. They triumphed in part because of their sharp, unifying goal. Think about how you can sharpen your team's goal and make it the most important priority for everyone on the team. That way, team members will downplay their own selfish agendas and commit to the team's decisions. Do you fight and unite? Do you argue your points of view forcefully yet let the best arguments win? Do you eventually set the fighting aside, let the issue go, and unite behind decisions? When you lead teams, do you make it possible for others to join in rigorous debates and then forge unity? To gauge your skill level at fighting and uniting, take the assessment You as Team Participant in the PDF included with this program. If you're a participant, your position on the chart indicates what kind of behaviors you bring to the team. For example, if you land in the group think area, you strive for unity but don't challenge others in debate. You go along just to get along. If you land in the anarchy area, you're that annoying colleague who never offers constructive solutions to problems, but who, at the same time, never supports the solutions that others come up with. If you're a team leader, your position on the chart indicates the kind of behavior likely taking place among people on your team. If you land in the fight and undermine area, your team excels at debating, but you're having trouble forging unity around the final decision. This situation can lead to difficulties with implementation. If you're in the groupthink domain, your team affords a very nice environment. Everyone is going along to get along, yet you're not challenging one another enough to produce the best decisions. To improve, pinpoint your position in the chart. Then select relevant tactics from among those described in this chapter to move yourself into the fight and unite corner. Becoming a better fighter and uniter in teams will lift your own individual performance. The teams you're on will do better, and those results will reflect positively on you. To fight and then unite allows you to tap into the group's collective wisdom and harness the power of a team. But beware, great teams can fall into a trap. They can become so good at working together that they shut out the rest of the world. They forget that excellent work requires collaboration among many teams, not just work within a single insulated team. In the next chapter, we'll explore how to improve your own performance by collaborating more effectively across team boundaries. Key insights. Fight and unite. The work harder convention. To maximize a team's performance, and by implication your own, solicit the participation of the best and brightest. Then, maximize team effort by scheduling plenty of meetings. If a meeting fails to work, schedule another, and so on. The new work smarter perspective. To maximize performance, maximize team debate and team unity. To have a good fight in a team, prioritize diversity over individual talent. When you fight and unite well, you don't need follow-up meetings because your team discussed it well the first time. You meet smart. Key points. A full 80% of respondents in our study acknowledged, leading teams effectively is really important in my job. Whether as a leader or a participant, you achieve not alone, but with teams. Much of a team's joint work occurs in group meetings. Your team's effectiveness and your own individual performance, therefore, hinge on the quality of those meetings. Yet most people, 69% according to one study, complain that their meetings aren't productive. In our study, many people struggled with two important aspects of team meetings. Some failed to hold rigorous fights or debates in which they explored ideas and scrutinized assumptions. Some also failed to commit to decisions once they were made and to work hard to implement them, to unite as a team. In either case, team meetings suffered and an employee's individual performance diminished. To have a productive fight in meetings, pursue the following strategies either as leader or participant. Maximize diversity, not talent. Make it safe to speak up. Prod the quiet to speak. Show up as an advocate, not a salesperson. Ask non-leading questions. To improve team unity, try the following. Ensure everyone has a voice. Being heard creates buy-in. Commit, especially when you utterly disagree. Confront the prima donna. Sharpen the team goal. Stop playing office politics and get behind decisions. 8. The two sins of collaboration. Sticks in a bundle are unbreakable. Kenyan proverb. It was November 2012, and Tom Wilson, not his real name, was in the hospital again. At age 68, the divorced veteran suffered from a long list of ailments, including ischemic cardiomyopathy, which decreased his heart's ability to pump blood, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which made breathing difficult, congestive heart failure, diabetes, kidney disease, depression, pulmonary hypertension, and back pain. Over a period of 14 months, he visited the emergency room 6 times. Wilson lived by himself in Fort Dodge, Iowa, a rural farming community of 25,000. Although he enjoyed regular access to medical specialists, getting his caregivers to communicate and coordinate with one another seemed impossible. During his stays at Fort Dodge Hospital, each of which lasted about 2 weeks, Wilson bounced between his primary care physician, pulmonologist, renal physician, cardiologist, and gastroenterologist, as well as between staff from the outpatient clinic, emergency room,
a skilled care unit, and an inpatient hospital unit. 9 different medical units in all. No one seemed to know what the others had done. Wilson worried whether he was getting the care he needed to manage his chronic conditions and keep him well. Unfortunately, Wilson wasn't alone in experiencing the lack of coordination, as we found out in the Harvard Business School case that I wrote on the hospital together with Professor Amy Edmondson and doctoral candidate Ashley K. Fryer. A clinic staffer explained, "There were times when a patient would show up to their primary care physician for their follow-up hospital visit 2 to 3 weeks after hospitalization, and the primary care physician had no clue the patient had been recently hospitalized." Another staffer complained that no one was looking at the big picture of the patient and taking part of that responsibility. Every specialist that was working on the patient's case was only looking at their individual piece of the patient. Since care wasn't coordinated, doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, and home aides ordered duplicate tests and examinations and failed to understand the full implications of the courses of treatment they recommended. Patients received lower quality care, and the local healthcare system incurred much higher costs. Two bad extremes of collaboration. These caregivers committed what we might call the first sin of collaboration. Under-collaboration. The health system in Fort Dodge wasn't designed to help people coordinate decision-making and share information. Like most hospital systems in the United States, Fort Dodge Hospital was composed of departments that were separated by tall walls, what many call a siloed organization. This phenomenon of siloed care has expanded in recent years. Specialization has exploded. The American Board of Medical Specialties listed 65 specialties in 1985, 124 in 2000, and 136 in 2017. Meanwhile, the fragmentation of care has led to serious problems. A large study of 10,740 patient admissions across 9 hospitals in the United States found that poor communication in handoffs from one provider to another resulted in many medical errors. When staff learned to use a simple communication tool, injuries from those errors decreased by 30%. When people fail to communicate across silos, bad things happen. It's hard enough to work well within teams, as we heard in the last chapter, but with entrenched silos, many individuals struggle as well to collaborate across boundaries. By collaborating, I mean connecting with people in other groups, obtaining and providing information, and participating in joint projects. Those groups include other teams, divisions, sales offices, departments, geographic subsidiaries, and business units. The solution, experts say, is simple. Bust the silos. Demolish all those walls so individuals and teams can coordinate with one another unhindered. In the name of silo busting, these experts want more interactions, committees, and joint task forces across units. It's a way of thinking typified by former General Electric CEO Jack Welch's famous boundaryless company. Inevitably, this ideal trickles down to employees, leading to a pervasive belief that collaboration is good and more of it is even better. Swayed by this belief, many of us proceed to commit a second sin of collaboration. Over-collaboration. I remember when this insight first dawned upon me. Martine Haas, then a doctoral student, now a Wharton Business School professor, and I were in my office at Harvard Business School. We were studying data from 182 sales teams in a large information technology consulting firm. Top managers at Centra Consulting, a disguised name, believed that they had to bust all their silos to get the company's 10,000 consultants spread across more than 50 offices to share more knowledge. The managers launched a knowledge management system that consultants could use to look up experts and download past client presentations. They rewarded cooperation across offices. A norm of collaboration took hold. The managers had succeeded in busting their silos. To test the benefit of the knowledge-sharing approach, Martine and I posed a simple question.
Did sales teams that collaborated more with colleagues in different offices win more of their client bids? We plugged in data about a bunch of factors in our statistical model. Our first result showed no effect. We blinked at the computer screen, dumbfounded. How could more collaboration not have made a difference? Probing deeper, we discovered that actually some teams that had received input from colleagues from different offices had won their bid, while others lost it. That was odd. Same collaboration input, vastly different outcomes. We sifted through many possible explanations. Did the number of people on a given team affect the sales outcome? No. How about the competitive situation facing the team? No. How about the size of the deal? No. Then we discovered one factor that did influence whether a team won or lost. Experience. Ding. Teams with minuscule experience in either the topic of the bid or the client's industry benefited from outside help. That was obvious. After the fact, of course. By contrast, teams with deep expertise fared worse when receiving input from colleagues. The more help they received, the lower their chances of winning the sales bid. These teams spent precious time searching for experts and later trying to incorporate their advice. They wound up dealing with more conflict and produced more chaotic, less effective sales proposals. These teams over-collaborated because no compelling reason existed for them to seek outside help. Why did smart, seasoned professionals request help from colleagues across the firm when they didn't need it? Interviewing individual consultants, we learned that they felt pressure to collaborate. "There's a norm around here that you ought to collaborate," they told us. "If you don't ask for help, it can count against you." And so they collaborated, even though they lacked a compelling reason. They applied an old-fashioned, work-harder approach to collaboration, exerting extra effort to obtain and incorporate knowledge, aiming for quantity of collaboration, not quality. As a result, they did worse. In the study for this book, we found plenty of instances in which over-collaboration compromised performance. Connor, a 31-year-old marketing analyst in a Minnesota retail company, grumbled that people from other business units constantly ask me for help on trivial things, which prevents me from focusing on my task at hand. That lack of focus, in turn, caused him to disappoint his bosses. Not too much, not too little. It's clear, then, that over-collaboration and under-collaboration can both stymie employees and managers trying to perform at their best. Clinging to silos leaves you in the same unhappy situation as Fort Dodge Hospital, while busting silos can swing you to the opposite extreme of too much collaboration, as at Centra Consulting. My research has uncovered an approach that keeps you within the two extremes of collaboration. Disciplined collaboration, as I call it, is a set of practices that allows you first to assess when to collaborate and when not to, and to implement the effort so that people are both willing and able to commit to it and deliver results. In my previous book, Collaboration, I detailed how leaders can design an organization, its structure, incentives, and culture to promote disciplined collaboration. In this chapter, I outline how an individual, junior or senior, can implement 5 disciplined collaboration rules to improve his or her own performance. In our 5,000-person dataset, we found that individuals who practiced disciplined collaboration were likely to perform far better than those who didn't. People who mastered disciplined collaboration were likely to rank 14 percentage points higher in their performance ranking than those who scored at the bottom. Interestingly, women benefited twice as much as men from disciplined collaboration. Why might women benefit so much more from collaborating? Our data revealed that a higher proportion of women were good at building trust, ensuring that parties were motivated and crafting a common goal. More women were also better at seeking information outside their core team.
This gender effect is the second among the seven practices in this book. Women in our study did better collaborating, while men did better championing forcefully, as discussed in Chapter 6. With this gender difference in mind, let's now examine the disciplined collaboration rules to see why they produce better results for both men and women in our study. First ask, why collaborate?